welcome to our third episode of Uncharted Maritime Tales, a podcast that has been created to discuss not just archaeology, but maritime archaeology. We're your hosts, Greta
and Jasmine, and we are project officers of the Maritime Archaeology Trust. And that's a charity that creates outreach resources to share heritage with the world.
These resources are an important outcome for our Fathoming the Future project, which aims to break down any boundaries to heritage and tell new stories, all made possible thanks to the National Lottery Heritage Fund.
And as it's International Day of Women in Maritime on May the 18th, for this podcast we want to celebrate women in maritime history, their stories and their determination. For the Fathoming Project, we hosted a day in September last year at the Shipwreck Centre on the Isle of Wight. And on this day, we invited local women from the local area to explore the museum so they could connect with those stories and share what resonated with them. It also inspired one of our Fathoming volunteers, Maggie, to research more about women and their connection to maritime heritage through their own experiences.
An International Day of Women in Maritime is also a wonderful day to consider any woman connected to the maritime world who inspires you. Now, when we say connected to the maritime world, it could be anything, really. It could be a woman who's a diver, an archaeologist, a pioneer of discipline, a heroic woman in maritime history, or even people like naval engineers. There are just so many women who could come under the umbrella of this topic.
Whether it's women like Dr. Margaret Rule, who worked on the Mary Rose, and also she contributed to the passing of the Protection of Wrecks Act of 1973,
or Joan Duplat Taylor, a British archaeologist who was the first president of the Nautical Archaeology Society and was instrumental in setting up the International Journal for Nautical Archaeology and was the founder editor from 1972 to 1980.
And of course, we also have Anna Frost, who we'll be talking a lot about a little bit later.
Absolutely, the incredible Anna Frost. But before we get to Anna, we have a segment created by two of our Fathoming the Future volunteers. It's being read by Katie Macavalia, and it was written by Daisy Plant, who is an author and has previously written a book on local women in history entitled A History of Women's Lives on the Isle of Wight. This segment is actually a reading of a blog Daisy wrote for the Trust, so you can find the text on our website. It's called Women in Maritime History.
Women in maritime history, as with many other areas of our past, are often overlooked and forgotten. This doesn't mean that they had nothing to contribute, just that these things were either barely recorded or simply lost to time. Uncovering these stories is a vital part of understanding our past. There have always been women in these areas traditionally considered masculine. Here are the stories of three such women. These stories were written and researched by author Daisy Plant, who has written a book, A History of Women on the Isle of Wight, telling stories of remarkable women who were not queens or courtesans, but all have incredible stories to tell. We begin with the story of Ethel Langton. In March of 1926, when she was just 15 years old, Ethel Langton found herself left home alone with her dog, Badger, for 3 days and three nights. What made this especially remarkable was that she lived in St. Helen's Fort, located in the Solent. Her father was a lighthouse keeper there, and after a break in the storm, went ashore with his wife to fetch supplies to bring back. Unfortunately, the storm returned while Ethel's parents were away, and it was too dangerous for them to make the return journey. In their absence, Ethel kept the lighthouse going by herself. In order to keep the light on, she would have needed to wind up the clockwork apparatus every 4 hours. All through the night for 3 days, in a constant storm. She later said that she spent her time playing patience, reading, and preparing meals. She was found by three fishermen with only half a loaf of bread and a piece of cake left to sustain her. Ethel was awarded the Lloyd's Bronze Medal for her bravery, which is on display at the Shipwreck Centre and Maritime Museum in the Isle of Wight. She was the first woman to receive this honour. The Westminster Gazette also reported she was flooded with letters and gifts from both home and abroad sent by fans. Ella Trout was a fisherwoman from Hull Sands in Devon. She and her sister Patience dropped out of school when her father fell sick in order to operate their family's fishing boat, as it was their family's only source of income. He passed away in 1910, when the girls were 14 and 15 years old. In 1917, during the First World War, Ella was out fishing with her cousin, William, aged 10, when they had witnessed an explosion. A ship, the New Holm, had just been torpedoed off Stark Point by a submarine. The pair raced towards it. As the wind was blowing in the wrong direction for them to use their sail, they had to row. They were able to rescue one of the crew members. He was a fireman on board the vessel, and he explained what had happened. As Ella and William were helping him, a motorboat also arrived to aid in the rescue. 22 crew members were unable to be saved on that day. For her role in the rescue, Ella received an OBE. Blanche Cool Thornycroft. Blanche's father, John Isaac Thornycroft, was a naval architect and engineer. He was the founder of Thornycroft Shipping Company and received a knighthood for his work. Blanche was something of an unofficial apprentice. She seems to have been trained by her father's craft in a way expected of an apprentice, but was never referred to as such during her lifetime. Indeed, she seems to have tried to actually downplay her own role in a lot of the work the company did, although her own notes and letters portray just how involved she was. Her family also often spoke of her mathematical prowess. The family home in Benbridge, Isle of Wight, had a specially built testing tank for model ships. This was disguised as a decorative water feature and nicknamed the Lily Pond. Ship models were towed at a controlled velocity with equipment housed nearby to measure their results. A larger testing facility was later built at the Steinwood Battery. The experiments conducted and recorded on both these places were key to the development of several ship designs, most notably for the Royal Navy. She continued to work after her father's death in 1928, when the company was taken over by her brother. In 1917, Blanche was one of the first three women to be made an associate of the Royal Institution of Naval Architects.
Daisy and Katie for that segment. There were three great stories there. Ethel's bravery and dedication to keeping others safe by keeping that lighthouse lit at just 15 years old always really sticks out to me.
I know. The idea that she had to wind the clockwork apparatus every 4 hours at night by herself in a store, it's just incredible. And if anyone would like to see Ethel's medals in person, they are on display in the Shipwreck Centre in the Isle of Wight, alongside a picture of Ethel with her faithful dog, Badger. Our Fathoming the Future volunteer, Mike Greaves, has also recently created a beautiful painting of Ethel climbing up the lighthouse, which you should be able to see on our socials very soon. Katie also spoke there about Blanche Thornycroft, who was quite local to Southampton because Thornycroft shipbuilders were dotted all over the city, and they were actually instrumental to the Second World War effort, as Thornycroft shipbuilders built several of the repair slipways for the landing craft before D-Day. And just to expand on that, if you're actually interested in women and engineering in particular, there is a new blog for this International Day of Women in Maritime. It's written by volunteer Roger Burns, and it's about Henrietta Vansittart, who worked as an engineer in Victorian Britain. And she was really groundbreaking in the field of engineering. She was awarded a patent for the low Vansittart propeller, which was fitted onto many ships and won her many awards. So you can visit our blogs page on our website to read it.
So that leads us nicely onto our next segment. And Greta is now going to talk to Lauren Tidbury, who's developing an exciting new project called Women and Protected Wrecks. Lauren is also a maritime archaeologist who works with us both at the MAT and for the Honor Frost Foundation. and we're going to hear more about the organisation's namesake now.
So I'm now joined by Lauren Tidbury. She is a maritime archaeologist and she works for the Honor Frost Foundation. Now, for those of you who don't know, the Honor Frost Foundation, it's based partially in the UK, but it focuses largely on the Eastern Mediterranean archaeology. The foundation was founded in 2011, shortly after the death of Honor Frost, who was a pioneer in the field of underwater archaeology. They also have their own podcast. It's called Dive and Dig. And if you're a fan of our topic today, their episode titled Women Leading the Way in Deep Water Archaeology is certainly not one to miss. So Lauren, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Brilliant. Yeah, thanks for having me.
I guess the first question that some people may have is, who was Anna Frost and what is her archaeological legacy?
Yeah, so Anna Frost, she's often referred to as a pioneer in underwater archaeology, but she was quite a lot more than that. She was really interesting, and also being a woman in the field of maritime archaeology in a time when it was sort of dominated by men, really, it just makes her really stand out for me. But she was born in Cyprus in 1917, and she was brought up there, but then her parents sadly died and she was orphaned. And she became the ward of a London solicitor, but she trained originally as an artist.
Wow.
Her artistic skills are amazing. If you get to go and have a look at her archive, like, her drawings are just particularly good.
Wow.
So she became a set designer for ballet.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and she did that for a very long time. And it wasn't actually until I think she was in her 40s, things started to change. And it was after some sort of late night rehearsals or something to do with ballet in London. She was in Wimbledon. And it just so happened that her friend was building this, they call it a well,
right,
in his garden, to try out some diving apparatus, some underwater breathing apparatus. And it was a December night, it was cold, it was snowy, and he said, do you want to have a go? And she was like, yeah.
Wow.
So she goes into this well and submerses herself in like 4 or 5 metres of water, pitch black. She's got a hose leading up to the surface to breathe, and
wow,
this big suit on, and she was quite a petite lady, so quite a heavy suit on. And for some reason, she went, oh, this is brilliant. This
wow
is what I want to do. So in the 50s, she went to France and she trained, you know, with the likes of Frédéric Dumas and Jacques Cousteau. And she learned to scuba dive in those very early days of scuba diving. And then she went to a land-based archaeological excavation in Jericho with Dame Kathleen Kenyon. And she was using her artistic skills, she was the draftsman for the site. And I think it was then that she realised that her love of diving and her skills of drawing and archaeological survey could be combined. And she started realising that she should be using those techniques and those standards on land, underwater as well. So she really kind of led the way. And then she was involved in the well-known Cape Gelidonia site in 1960 with George Bath. She went on to record the Pharos Lighthouse in Alexandria in the
60s.
Wow. Right. And then she was probably most well known in the 70s for excavating the Punic ship off Sicily,
right,
the Marsala Punic ship. So that's a 3rd century BC timber ship. And she spent 4 years in Sicily excavating the entire site. And that's a really cool site. And then she went on to look at harbours and anchors, pretty much everything. But I think she really kind of paved the way. And she was also very keen on, like, encouraging young scholars to get into the field. So yeah, then when she passed away, the foundation was sort of set up to carry on that legacy. Yeah.
Well, yeah, anyone who's been diving, even just in the summer, knows how cold the water can truly be. So going down into a well without any form of a dry suit is incredible.
And then to say, I love this.
Yeah, actually.
This is my new career. So yeah, something, I think she's got a book called Under the Med, she published in 1963, I think. And in that, she describes that first experience diving. And there's a really lovely quote where she just talks about this sort of, this peacefulness. And then obviously that carried on when she was scuba diving as well. I just think, she is quoted as saying that time spent on the surface is time wasted.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah,
what an incredible quote. Yeah.
I know. She just obviously felt really at home being
yes
underwater.
It's really interesting also what you just said about how she came into it through quite an artistic way, because that's one really interesting thing about archaeology. Some people come in through maths, some people come, there's not really an area where it doesn't feel like it's not relevant to archaeology, if that
exactly
makes sense.
Although I think she felt, because she didn't have an academic background, she sometimes felt a little bit out of place or something. I know she often brings this up in some of her interviews and some of the books that she writes, is that she often felt that she didn't quite fit in because she didn't have a degree in archaeology. But she was leading the way in all the techniques that are now being taught in those degrees. So
right, yes, yeah. I was going to ask about that, where you mentioned she was really interested in lots of areas. Was there a particular part of archaeology that she's really championed?
Yeah, I mean, harbour archaeology particularly. I think she was one of the first people to realise that you can understand, and you need to understand, landscape change and sea level change and climate change and that kind of thing to understand these sites and how they've become submerged. And then anchors. She's known as the Lady of Anchors. That became a bit of a thing, particularly stone anchors. And it's referred to as anchorology. And I think, yeah, she found them so interesting. She developed lots of techniques for how to record anchors, how to understand their provenance. So there's been, that's kind of led to quite a few other projects. And then there's the Big Anchor Project now from the NAS, funded by the Honor Frost Foundation.
Lauren is also part of a new project that we've started at the Trust called Women and the Protected Wrecks Project. It's just been established and set up and is running now. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yeah, so this was funded by Historic England as part of the 50th anniversary of the Protection of Wrecks Act. So that came out in 1973 to protect wrecks of historic significance. What that means is that to dive those sites, you have to have a licence, and they're looked after by a licensee, and they're monitored, and you can't damage that site. It's, you know, a legal designation on that ship to protect it. And so that's been going on for 50 years now, but something that we noticed was that there's very few women involved in the protected wreck scheme. So when you look at the licensees of those 50-odd wrecks, the visitor licences that are applied for people to go and dive on them, teams that make up, you know, the protected wrecks teams, there were very, very few women involved. There was only sort of one or two licensees at the time. There's a couple more now. But we were trying to understand, like, you know, why? What are the barriers for engagement? Why are there so few women involved? So we started this project to do a survey, first of all, to try and find out, not just from maritime archaeologists, but from anyone who's got an interest in just maybe, like a sports diver who might want to just go and dive on the site because they're just interested. So we want to, or, you know, conservators who are working on the material that come from protected wrecks, anyone in that has some link in some way, to find out from them their thoughts on it, perhaps why so few women are involved in it, what we could do to improve engagement with women on the site. So we've done a survey, and we're also interviewing quite a lot of women who've been involved in protected wrecks to find out any sort of barriers to them. And because in maritime archaeology more widely as a profession, I think it is quite, there's quite a good gender balance when you look at a lot of the organisations now and a lot of the women who are involved in diving. But for some reason on protected wrecks, it still seems to have that, yeah, a really low, yeah. So
yeah, that disconnect, yeah.
Yeah, we want to find out more.
Yeah.
So that's the project. So it's not long started. The survey's online. So if you go to the Maritime Archaeology Trust website and look it up, you can do the survey. And we just want to hear from anyone, really. And as well as that, we also want to look at women in the past. So looking at these protected wrecks, were there any women on board whose stories haven't been told? So we're looking into some of those and hoping to get volunteers involved in that as well. So.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, lots of ways to get involved. We will put a link to the survey in our YouTube video. So if you are interested in taking it, absolutely, please feel free to head there and go check it out. And that's really on this topic. Are there any stories that have stood out so far in the Women and Protected Wrecks project? Something that's really struck with you?
Someone who I thought was really interesting was Veronica Robbins. We spoke to her. She was like the first receiver of wreck.
Oh, right, yes.
And I think at the time, you know, she suddenly was dealing with all this wreck material that was built, being bought from all sorts of, you know, sites, not just protected wrecks. And people were like, oh, it's a woman. And she said it was this sort of surprise.
Yes,
and this,
yeah.
It was a pretty tough lady. Bizarrely, and this is going off on a tangent, I found out that one of her roles within the receiver of wreck was not just dealing with wreck material, she had to deal with whales that get washed up on beaches.
Oh, wow!
So she'd suddenly have to sort out a beached whale up in Scotland. So a really diverse role that the receiver of wreck has.
Just so, sorry, in case anyone doesn't know, the receiver of wreck, what roughly do
So they work for the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency. So it's an official post. And basically, when you bring something up from a shipwreck. They all belong to someone, you know, whether it's the owner of the wreck or the insurance company that paid out for that, you have to declare it. And then the receiver of wreck will have a record of it and then try and find the owner and basically work out what to do with this material from then. So, yeah, it's a big role. Now, actually, I think there's several people involved in what she started. And they did this big, what does she call it, a wreck amnesty. Oh. And she led the way for that in 2000 to basically say, look, I know lots of people have been bringing up items from wrecks, maybe because they weren't aware of the legislation. We've got this amnesty, so you can declare it and there's not going to be any legal action. And she said the amount of ammunition that they had, because people are bringing up, you know, you've got World War One wrecks where this material's been down there for over 100 years, but it's still highly explosive.
Yes, yeah.
So, lots of ammunition was declared and all sorts of things like that. So
just imagine people turning up with, oh, actually, yeah, I found all of these.
Go. Yeah, so, yeah, she was a really cool, really cool to speak to. It was really a real privilege to speak to her. And
yeah, wow, what an incredible job.
So thank you, Lauren. As I think you picked up on in that interview, Greta, the thought of going down to the bottom of a well in an experimental diving equipment is terrifying to me.
Yeah, not the conventional route into diving, I would say. I wouldn't recommend that to anyone who's interested in getting into diving. A local swimming pool is just fine. We also touched there on the Women and Protected Threats project, which I think is a really valuable project as it sounds like it's going to highlight some important stories and remarkable women. One being Jane Maddox, who Lauren has interviewed recently. Now, Jane has a master's in maritime archaeology and she's been part of the dive team for some just incredible sites, including the Mary Rose, the Yarmouth Rhodes wreck. For those who may not know, that was a 16th century wreck that was found just off the Isle of Wight, and HMS Invincible, which was lost in 1758. And both wrecks are actually on the Maritime Archaeology Trust website if you'd like to learn more about them. So we're going to hear a small extract from one of Jane's interviews with Lauren now.
And then came the Mary Rose. And
right, so that was your first maritime.
That was my first maritime. And I can still today remember that first dive, because when you leapt off the platform, you went down the shot line. Right by the shot line, there was one of the guns, and it was barrel into the mud, so cascabel end sticking out. And people obviously touched it as they went past. So it was a bronze gun, so it glowed. So it wasn't very good viz, but it was this glowing gun, and everybody sort of patted it as you went past. And I can still remember the first time I patted it, and then went off to have a look, have a cook's tour and around the wreck. And as I patted it and left the shot, I absolutely knew that things had changed and it was never quite going to be the same again.
Wow.
Well, there you go. A little taste of one of those interviews conducted for the Women and Protected Wrecks project. I could just only imagine the feeling of jumping off of that platform and seeing the glowing gun for the very first time.
Yeah, it must have been incredible to be there for that defining moment in archaeology. And if you'd like to know more about women in protected wrecks, you can visit the project page on our website.
Well, that's all from us. Thank you so much for tuning in and hearing about some remarkable women. Feel free to get in contact if any of these stories have resonated with you. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. There's also a Linktree website, which we'll include in the description, where you can access all of our online platforms. And we also have a YouTube channel, which you can subscribe to, so you'll never miss any new information on maritime archaeology. Thank you very much. See you next time.
Thanks. Bye.